Great to have you with us on the Ideas Network. Larry Mueller here. Hi, it's time to take a look at wildlife in the winter with our two guests, David Drake and Jamie Knack. Jamie's an Extension Senior Wildlife Outreach Specialist. Jamie, welcome back.
Hey, Happy New Year, Larry.
Happy New Year to you. David Drake is an Extension Wildlife Specialist and Professor, and they're both in the Department of Forest and Wildlife Ecology. David, good to see you as well.
Good to see you in this new year as well, Larry. Thank you.
And, of course, we want to hear from you as we talk with them. Do you take part in Bald Eagle Watching Days, perhaps? Do you have any winter hiking recommendations? What other wildlife questions do you have? Join in at 1-800-642-1234, or you could send an email to ideas@wpr.org, ideas@wpr.org. Jamie, let's start with you. Can you tell us more about the new black bear reproduction study that the DNR is taking on?
Yeah, actually, no problem. And it's kind of a call out for citizens to help support the science as well. So as you do get outdoors in these blustery weather conditions that we're going to have, be on the lookout for black bear dens. Or maybe you know in the past where you've had a black bear den on your property. The DNR is actually asking for assistance in locating dens so that they can do a study where they're going in late winter and removing the sows and the cubs and getting weights, looking at taking some blood, taking some hair samples, looking at litter sizes, age of the bears, weight, and some other body measurements that can help with understanding the overall condition of the bears. But the idea here is to help refine survey or models that are being used to estimate bear populations in the various zones in the state. So we manage our bear population, which is estimated at about 24,000 animals, through the use of six zones. And those zones were just kind of redefined and renamed over this past year. And that helps us manage at a more local level the various bear population. So we know bears are typically in the northern third of the state, but we also have very healthy bear populations in the central and the western part of the state. And just with the abundant food sources that we have in the state of Wisconsin, it's really facilitated not just the movement of a young male bear, but actually breeding animals in southern Wisconsin, that we now have six zones. So to better manage the various populations in these different zones, this will help give us more data so we can do zone-specific estimates of population numbers. So, and bears are super interesting in terms of the metabolic energy that they put in to have their young. So these dens, they in Wisconsin, they're typically using something associated with forests. So whether they might excavate that area where the tip up occurs at the root structure and use that as a den, or a brush pile, or a hollow log. In some cases, you know, the bears are not all that big, you know, a young sow, maybe just 150 pounds or so. And then otherwise they actually will kind of build a nest, say out of grasses, and actually be on the surface of
You're breaking up a little bit there. You're breaking up a little bit there, Jamie.
That better?
Keep going. Sorry. I would just say that the one I discovered a black bear down in the middle of the Shawamigan National Forest on a November deer hunt, and it had made a nest kind of in a blowdown that Jamie was describing earlier. But go ahead, David, and add to it.
Yeah, so I think, as Jamie was saying, a lot of times you'll find them out in just natural areas, exactly as she's described, under tip-ups or in hollow logs or what you described there in the Shawamigan. But, you know, sometimes they've also denned under people's porches. And things like that. So don't be surprised if you see a black bear denning in some maybe unexpected areas like that. And, you know, nowadays there's so many apps that we can put onto our smartphones. And if you do run across a den, if you can download or if you have an app downloaded, for example, that has coordinates on it where you can get latitude, longitude, or some type of GPS coordinates, the more specific you can location you can give to the Wisconsin Department of Natural Resources, the more helpful. But if you don't have coordinates, you know, try to estimate it distance-wise from the nearest intersection, large intersection, or something like that, so that when you do give some direction to the Wisconsin Department of Natural Resources, they can find that den relatively easily. And the other thing Jamie mentioned is, you know, the black bear population is estimated about 24,000, but it certainly seems like it's growing in the state of Wisconsin. And as that bear population grows, it's going to expand throughout the state. So it's not going to just be concentrated to the northern part of the state like it traditionally has been. And we've seen that where we've had bears in the active months, you know, spring, summer, down in the southern part of the state, around Madison, around Milwaukee, down through the Mississippi River Valley and things like that. So, yeah, it's a fascinating study that's going on. And more and more, they are reaching out to citizen scientists and asking the citizens of the public of Wisconsin to help, because that's a lot of extra eyes that the DNR has access to.
They're really fun to see in the wild. That's for that's for sure. They're fun to see loping. The one that I came upon woke up, unfortunately, and took off. And I don't know who was more surprised, me or the bear.
Yeah,
the bear went one direction, and I kind of stood there, and then thought about going in the other direction.
Yep, and you know, and like unlike polar bears or grizzly bears, black bears are relatively benign animals. I mean, you certainly want to observe them from a safe distance, and you certainly don't want to be between them and the cubs. You know, the sow and the cubs, the mom and the cubs, or present any danger or potential danger to the bears. But if you can observe them from a safe distance, they are wonderful to watch, and they're just fascinating animals, absolutely. And they're a big animal as well. Yeah. So, you know, they get upwards of 700 pounds, and that's a pretty sizable and impressive animal.
Absolutely. Jane from Madison emailed a question. She said that an opossum is in her yard after being attracted by probably birdseed. And Jane wants to know if she should create a winter shelter for the opossum, and if so, any instructions on how to create one, or any resources for critter shelters like that.
All right,
you're back.
Yeah, let's see how long that stays. I moved rooms, so must be having some internet connection issues here, which we can all relate to. So possums are interesting. They do not hibernate. They'll den up, or like during the weather that we have now, they may hold up in a brush pile or a rocky outcropping or a hollow log or a den tree to kind of wait past this cold weather and the snow. But otherwise, they're out foraging, much like a raccoon would be. And you're probably exactly right. Your bird feeder is what's attracting that animal into your yard. So, omnivores, they'll, you know, scrounge on all sorts of types of food, even carrion. And as far as providing habitat, you know, you certainly could. What you would want to think about is maybe a brush pile. And I don't know that I would get into feeding.
We're losing you again. Probably not a good idea to be feeding, David, the animals.
Yeah, for sure. You know, you shouldn't be feeding any animal, any wild animal other than birds in your backyard, in all honesty. And again, depending on where you are, it's illegal to feed deer if you're in a CWD county or a county that abuts a positive CWD. So there are some legal issues and ethical reasons why you don't want to feed animals outside of, again, backyard birds. But yeah, for possums, you know, the other thing that's interesting about possums is that they've exceeded their northern range. And so they really historically have not belonged or have not been found in Wisconsin. And if you've ever looked at a possum, their tail is furless and their ears are furless. So a possum that has been in Wisconsin for a number of years, a lot of times because they do not hibernate in the wintertime, that it's common to see a possum with part of their ear, part of their tail missing, because that hairless flesh has gotten frostbit during a previous winter, and is that flesh or that tissue has then died off. So if you want to try to do something for possums, probably the best thing to do is put out some kind of a, some sort of a shelter where they can climb into it or get into a shelter either under your deck, or you can put out a piece of a culvert pipe or something like that where they can get in there and get away from the wind and maybe some of the really cold temperatures.
Have my next door neighbor has a hot tub that, of course, sits on the outdoor deck or off to the side of it, and it's enclosed, of course, around the bottom, and the opossum took up residence one winter, found a way to get in to inside that area. He always kept it going, so yeah. Opossum had pretty nice living conditions.
Yep. And, you know, we find that with other animals. Monk parakeets, for example, are a species that are not native to America. And we have monk parakeets in Chicago. And obviously, as a parakeet would suggest, they're kind of a more of a subtropical animal. But they're able to exist in Chicago, and especially the Chicago winters, because they build nests around these large electrical transformers. And those transformers are giving off so much heat that they're able to survive that cold Chicago winter by using the heat coming off those transformers, similar to what the possum was doing with your neighbor's hot tub.
Matt from Madison emailed that he saw a peregrine falcon through the Blount Street Falcon camera on MG&E's website. He saw both a male and a female in the last week.
That's exciting to see those birds. And, you know, peregrine falcons are a kind of a success story in terms of conservation. They were one of the species that was falling susceptible to DDT, which was a pesticide used back in the 1950s. And, you know, I think it was banned in the 70s. But essentially, peregrine falcon populations were declining because of DDT use and some other reasons. But one of the things about peregrine falcons is that they typically will use these rocky outcrops and cliff faces and things like that, and they'll nest in those areas. And it also gives them kind of a perch from which they can stoop or dive onto other birds. And peregrine falcons, one of the things they eat primarily is other birds, such as pigeons and sparrows and things like that. And so peregrine falcons have adapted to living in cities. And because in cities you have these tall buildings that kind of replicate these cliff faces, these natural cliff faces. And so peregrine falcons will nest on top of the buildings. And a lot of times people will put out a nesting box or a hack box up on top of the roof of a building that a peregrine falcon might be using. And off these tall buildings, not only are they nesting there, but there's a lot of perching areas for them to stoop or to dive from. And there's a lot of birds in cities, such as starlings and English sparrows and pigeons. And so it's kind of like, you know, the equivalent of the human being driving through the McDonald's parking lot or driving through the McDonald's drive-thru to get food for these peregrine falcons living in the cities.
David Drake and Jamie Nack, our guests today, taking a look at the world of wildlife. And you can join in. The number to call is 1-800-642-1234, 1-800-642-1234, or email us to ideas@wpr.org. Have a question about wildlife, or maybe you're doing some fun things in the outdoors? Hope you'll join in. I'm Larry Mueller. Mackenzie Crummy, our producer today, Tyler Ditter, our engineer. You're listening to the Ideas Network. So great to have you with us on the Ideas Network. Larry Mueller here with my two guests, David Drake and Jamie Nack, as we look at the world of wildlife in our state. Join in at 800-642-1234 or email us to ideas@wpr.org. Jamie, back to you. A kid's activity this winter is the Keep Wildlife Wild poster contest. Can you tell us about that contest?
Yeah, sure can, and hopefully I won't cut out on everybody. So this is pretty exciting. So the Keep Wildlife Wild program began in 2014, and it was an initiative with the Department of Natural Resources Extension. It was something I was involved with and continue to be involved with, and then Wisconsin Wildlife Rehabilitators. And the goal with this program is really to provide the public with the knowledge and the confidence to make the right decision when they encounter wildlife, especially young wildlife in the spring, in the summer, or any time of year, but typically when we're out and about and it's spring baby season for wildlife. And we're trying to make sure that the public understand the unique qualities of wild animals and that they differ from domestic or human babies. And to be able to make decisions on when an animal is truly orphaned, is sick or injured, and kind of what to do next. So this effort has involved a lot of outreach, but also the development of a very nice website from the Wisconsin DNR's website. So if you go to DNR's main page and just type in Keep Wildlife Wild, you'll get to a very well-developed website that includes information on various commonly taken in animals or reported to wildlife rehab centers, but kind of what their natural ecology is, when they can be on their own, when they need help, in addition to links to find a local wildlife rehabilitator near you. There's a really nice PowerPoint that educators can use, or if you homeschool, that you can use with your children. And then also some activities, some dilemma cards that you can really use for educational curriculum, whether that be at home or in the public school system. So getting to the contest then, for the last couple of years, we've run a contest, and the contest is a poster contest, and it's designed for grades 4th through 6th grade. And for students who attend public, private, parochial, or are homeschooled in Wisconsin. And the idea, the theme this year is if you care, leave them there. And there's specific instructions on the submission process for the posters and what you can and can't do, but also that it needs to include the words Keep Wildlife Wild, and then use your own artistic creativity to depict what that means to keep wildlife wild. So the insider tip here is to go spend some time on those websites, exploring the key messages that we're trying to get to the public, and work to incorporate those into that poster. And then you can submit the poster via email, or you can mail a original copy. And then we'll be reviewing those and making decisions. So the deadline to submit is February 18th. And again, all the contest rules are on the DNR's website. And then once we select our winners, they will be announced in early April during Keep Wildlife Wild Week in Wisconsin.
That is pretty cool. I've had a chance to judge some poster contests in the past that children have done here in the state. And it's always a lot of fun. And they do a wonderful job. The kids are really good. Good at it.
It becomes a very difficult job in judging those. Yes. and deciding the various levels. So, yeah. Very creative and impressive. On certainly not a talent I have. So very impressive to see the creativity that others have.
Let's take another call. Doug in Mount Horeb, thank you for calling. What's on your mind?
The beginning of the program that you were looking for suggestions on places to go winter hiking, and there's a really neat remote park in the town of Perry, southwest of Mount Horeb. It's called the Hauge Historic District Park. It's H-A-U-G-E, Hauge Historic District Park. They have a little website, which is haugehistoricdistrictpark.org, where you can download a park brochure and a hiking trail map. It's about 30 acres. There's about 5 acres of hiking trails that are all mowed, and so they're low when you hike in the snow in the wintertime. The parking area is open in the winter. There's a observation point that's the most people don't know. It's the second highest observation point in Dane County, second to Blue Mounds, and that elevation is actually on the ground. You don't have to climb up anywhere. So you can see 30 miles in all directions on the ground. And the park surrounds the Howie Log Church National Historic Site, which is up there too. And if you want to watch a sunset in the wintertime, it's been voted the best place to watch a sunset in Dane County by Madison Magazine. So there you go.
Oh, thank you so much, Doug. You know, I have not been there, the Hauge Historic District Park. Have either of you been there?
I've not. That's the first I'm hearing about it. But this is exactly why I was hoping, you know, this topic would, these are the type of calls that I was hoping this would generate, is some of these hidden gems that are all over the state. So thank you very much for sharing. We'll have to check that one out.
Yeah, absolutely. Doug, thanks a lot. Appreciate it. Well, let's turn to Nancy in Madison next. Nancy, hi.
Hi. In regards to the comment about feeding birds, I had two things. I've seen a lot of posts recently that humans are thinking it's a great accomplishment to have the birds eating out of the hands. And I'm wondering with all of the diseases these days, if that's really good for the birds. And then the other, if you could comment about not feeding bread to waterfowl, considering the last rescue on Bakken's Pond of a swan.
Okay. Yeah. David, do you want to take that?
I'll jump in, and Jamie, please add on to that. So, ideally, birds don't really need our help, in all honesty. So we feed birds more for the benefit of us. And I'm not suggesting you don't feed birds because there are tremendous benefits for us and natural education and environmental education for children and things like that. But in all honesty, birds don't necessarily need our help. And if you really wanted to do something and not feed birds, if you planted native vegetation, especially vegetation that was fruiting or providing some food source through the winter and into early spring, that would satisfy the need to feed birds outside. With that being said, there's absolutely nothing wrong with feeding birds, but you should not have them come to your hand for a variety of reasons, because as that happens, that's an indication that birds are starting to habituate or get used to human beings. And we want wild animals to have a natural fear of human beings, even those animals that live in cities and amongst the human population, because that's the way that we are going to keep some kind of a buffer or separation between the humans and the wildlife. And that's what's going to keep the wildlife safe. That's what's going to keep the human beings safe from disease spread, from attacks. So, for example, with coyotes attacking pets or human beings or something like that. So the more that we can keep a healthy and natural fear of humans in wild animals, either whether those animals are in rural areas or urban areas, the better it is for the human population, and certainly the better it is for the wildlife population. So we would encourage people not to do that. As fun as it might be from a picture-taking standpoint or just having that bird in your hand, but again, please don't do that. I'm not familiar with the swan and bread issue, Jamie. Maybe you are, and if you are, add into this, but typically bread it is not a very nutritious food source for birds. There's just nothing there for them, like a oiled sunflower seed or millet or these other seeds that you might get at a bird store or a feed store or something like that. So typically bread is not a good food source for any animal, and in particular for waterfowl or birds.
All right, there we go. Thank you, Nancy, very much for calling. You can join in too, 800-642-1234, or email to ideas@wpr.org. Let's go to Ryan in Barneveld next. Hi, Ryan.
Yeah, I'm wondering what I can do to control sparrows in my barn other than hiring a falconer to come take them out with a falcon or something.
So many ways for birds, the sparrows, to get in. Who wants to take that? Let's see. Jamie wants to take that.
Sure. So actually, your first thought, I'm not sure you'd have to hire a falconer, in that many of them would love that opportunity to have a source of being able to fly their bird and to hunt their bird. So definitely something to keep in mind, and I wouldn't be surprised if there's falconry groups or discussion boards out there that you could come across. So certainly something to think about. Obviously talking about exclusion or closing up all the holes on a barn is kind of a mute point. That's very difficult to accomplish. So to the best that you can, you can use mesh screening to close off access to certain areas and still allow for the airflow. That's important. And being careful about, how much extra food is around. And I realize in a working farm, those two things are quite a challenge. You also may be able to reach out to Wildlife Services and see what options they have for being able to remove some of those animals. They commonly work in agricultural systems with starlings and kind of in that realm. So Wildlife Services has offices in Rhinelander and Waupun, and their state offices in Sun Prairie. You should be able to look them up on the internet and give them a call.
Yeah, there we go. Thank you, Ryan, for calling. Appreciate it. Lisa from East Troy emailed and said she's having a nuisance badger in her horse pasture, wondering how to get rid of the badger. Can she call the DNR? She's concerned her horses will hurt their feet in the badger's holes that they're digging. David?
Yeah, I'll start with this one. So badgers are a protected species in the state of Wisconsin. The DNR has attempted a couple of times to try to get some information on the population of badgers, and it's proven to be very difficult, primarily because the badgers are hard to track. But there's probably a decent amount of them around, but even so, they're still a protected animal, so you would have to work through the Wisconsin Department of Natural Resources to do anything in your particular pasture. And probably the best thing to do is to contact your the county biologist for the Wisconsin Department of Natural Resources, and you can go, if you just Google Wisconsin DNR, there's a on the homepage, there's a place that says contact, and you can find your county biologist that way if you want to. But that's probably the best thing to do. Badgers are obviously a state animal. They're active year round, but they're relatively nocturnal. But obviously, they do dig quite a bit. They're what's called a fossorial animal. They live underground primarily. But not only do they dig a burrow to live in, but they also dig a lot of holes as they explore different food sources like chipmunks and 13-line ground squirrels and some other animals like that. So if you have a badger in your area, you can actually see quite a few holes that are either being used as a dig for food source or they're being used as a burrow. But nonetheless, the DNR is the agency you'll have to work through to remedy that situation.
There we go. Thank you so much for that question. Jan emailed and said she thinks she spotted a black coyote on her trail cam. Jan has seen the coyote twice, one in January of 2021 and again in December, so 12 months later. How rare are black coyotes in Wisconsin, and could these two sightings be the same one?
What location, Larry, did she say?
No.
Yeah, that was going to be my question too. Is, you know, I wonder where she's located in Wisconsin. So from my knowledge of coyotes, they're pretty uniform in their color. Now you can get one that's a little reddish, more rusty colored along the back line, or maybe a little bit darker, but not to the point where they're black. And so depending on where she's located, a wolf is certainly a possibility. And I would just encourage her, if she does have those pictures and she wants to send them to David and I, we'd be happy to take a look and provide a more definitive answer to her. But I would tend to think it's probably not a coyote if it's predominantly black.
So, Jan, you could maybe email us back. And if you've got if you can attach a picture, that would be wonderful. We'd love to take a look at it, because you've certainly piqued my interest. Where you're from.
Yeah, another option is, you know, it could be a domestic dog. It could also be a fisher, which we see people, you know, just not familiar with what a fisher looks like, and they can appear pretty dark colored and uniformly dark. So, yeah.
Jen's in Vilas County, by the way.
Oh, okay. Yeah. So
yeah, certainly.
That would suggest wolf.
All of those animals are within that realm. So
there you go. You can join in, too. Number to call, 1-800-642-1234, or you could email us, the email address, ideas@WPR.org, ideas@WPR.org. Boy, J.J. Lins emailed photos of handcrafted birdhouses. I don't know if you can see those. You should be able to see those.
Yep, I got them on my email.
They're shaped like faces of people and carved out of wood, and they are really, really cool.
They're
Larry,
impressive.
How can we share those with the listeners? I don't know if he maybe has a website, but they're incredible. He's obviously a very gifted carver.
Well, it does bring to mind we're going to talk a bit about birdhouses on the show, and So maybe it's time to do that.
We can do that, certainly. You know, one thing I would only suggest, as Jamie said, that, you know, she has trouble creating posters and being creative like that. I could never create a birdhouse like that to save my life because it is ridiculously impressive. The only issue I will say from that is it looks like perhaps the birdhouses are being varnished or there's some kind of a lacquer on there. And typically with birdhouses in particular, the recommendation is not to lacquer or varnish the birdhouse because you want that wood to breathe. And sometimes if the birdhouse is out in the sun, it holds the heat inside the house. And sometimes the internal temperature can get a little bit uncomfortable and even lethal for the birds in there. So that's the only constructive criticism I might give about that, other than it is unbelievably impressive to see these birdhouses. And Jamie, again, I'll start off, but please jump in because I know you've got a lot of information about this, and you and your daughters and husband and your dad all create a lot of woodworking for birdhouses and things like that. But this is a great time if you're looking for a project to build some birdhouses, bat houses, bird feeders, anything like that. When there's a kind of a downtime for the winter and you're looking for a project, you can get even after as you build them, you can start putting them out onto the landscape now. And typically, if it's birds, for example, you know, we may get bluebirds that come back to Wisconsin by February sometimes, late February, something like that. So if you put the birdhouses out now, the bluebirds, as they come back and start getting onto territory, they'll find those birdhouses and start using them, for example. Bat houses, again, you know, probably by late April, May, something like that, the bats are starting to get active. So you certainly want all these houses and things like that on the landscape before the animals start returning or becoming active, from migration or hibernation, whatever the case is. There's a lot of good woodworking for birds and bats out there, a lot of good guides. I'm going to suggest a couple. I know Jamie's probably got some really good suggestions as well, but one that I really appreciate is by Carol Henderson, who's a retired Minnesota Department of Natural Resources non-game biologist. And he created a book called Woodworking for Wildlife, Homes for Birds and Animals. And it's got a lot of wonderful information about the life history and the ecology of different species you might build for. It's got plans in the back of them, specific plans about how you'd lay out your birdhouses and things like that. Through the University of Wisconsin Extension, Scott Craven and Bob Ellerson, along with another author, created shelves, houses, and feeders for birds and mammals, and that's still an active publication. And then if you're interested in bats and bat houses, probably the best place to go is Bat Conservation International, and that's a clearinghouse for all things research and management bat-related, and that's batcon.org, so batcon.org. And they've got a ridiculous amount of information out there in terms of bat house designs and where to locate them and all sorts of things like that. So I would suggest those as some resources. And Jamie, I know you've got some other suggestions as well, I'm sure.
Yeah, well, I was looking at kind of the phenology right now with, who's going to be needing a box first. And, some of our owl species are already going to be, doing courtship displays and will be our earliest breeders and nesters. So if you're interested, barred owls certainly will utilize a nest box, and those would be one of the first designs that you could think about and to get up, as well as David mentioned the bluebirds, but kestrel boxes. We put up a kestrel box in the yard a couple years ago, wood duck boxes. And then there's other things just in terms of little shelters or nesting structures that you can build for both birds and mammals as well. So lots of cool projects. And I guess one thing we should definitely mention is that you need to kind of build the box for the species you're interested in. So you want to think about what habitat do you have where you'd like to put a box, and then what species kind of, are in that habitat. So for example, if you have a forested area, you're probably not going to build bluebird houses because they need open grasslands to feed on insects and so on. So, or a wood duck needs to be not necessarily over a pond, but near water, within a quarter mile of water or so. So need to think about, the species, but then each species through research and designs, and the Bluebird Restoration Association of Wisconsin is a great organization to visit their website. They've done meticulous studies and data collection to look at nest box designs and come up with recommendations for Wisconsin for our bluebirds, and really comes down to two different style boxes. The NABS, which is short for North American Bluebird Society style box, or the Peterson box, which usually you build unvented, so you're not getting black flies. So you're not attracting black flies to the nest, which the nestlings can be susceptible to. So it's really important that you do some research and find the best design for the species that you're interested in. And another really great website that I've found that really highlights that is Cornell Lab of Ornithology has a program called Nest Watch, and you can go to their website and it'll talk all about, well, it'll give you dimensions and design plans and so on, but also where to put them and all of the ecology information for the species. So, and of course, the Bluebird Restoration Association of Wisconsin's website is excellent. Lots of great resources there. And the most recent magazine from the Wisconsin Natural Resources had an excellent article on how to build a bat house with pictures and tutorial from our Wisconsin bat specialist within the DNR. So that was a really nice article. And if you don't get that magazine, this would be a good issue to pick up. There's a lot of interesting things on beating the winter blues and ice fishing and enjoying Wisconsin's winter scenery. So
yeah, I love that magazine.
Yeah.
So
yep.
It's fun to have. Jen in Vilas County sent a photo of what she thought was a black coyote. You may have that in front of you. Looks like it could be a wolf. I don't know.
I'm sorry, Larry. I didn't mean to cut you off.
No, go ahead.
The black animal in the photograph, to me, looks like a wolf. Yeah. If you look at, especially that photo, and the listeners aren't going to see this, unfortunately, but there's a photo that she sent where the wolf is actually walking away from the camera. And if you look at the size of the paw and the leg length, which is relative without any reference there, but that looks like a wolf, and also the rounded ears and the profile picture she has of the snout looks more blunt and shorter. But the animal that's not black in there, to me, looks like it could be a coyote. Looking again at the ears and kind of the thinness of the snout. But again, you know, typically where you have wolves, coyotes are not very common because wolves will kill them to limit competition. So the black animal, I would say, is pretty certain to be a wolf. The animal that is more grizzled gray, I'm on the fence about whether that's a wolf or a coyote, and I'm leaning more toward coyote.
All right.
But Jamie, do you see those, or do you have a suggestion?
Yeah, I did, and I see them. And the one where I think it is a coyote, too, is looking at you. I think it's pretty obvious that it's a coyote. But there's another one with brownish gray coloring looking away that you can't see the face or the ears. That one looks pretty large. That could be a wolf, but that one I think is a little more uncertain just from the angle. But yes, I think the black one is definitely a wolf.
Yeah.
David Drake neat. And Jamie Nack are our guests today on the show as we talk the world of wildlife. Again, you can join us at 800-642-1234 or email to ideas@wpr.org. I'm Larry Mailer. You're listening to the Ideas Network. Taking a look at wildlife in Wisconsin today, Larry Mailer here with my guest David Drake, Extension Wildlife Specialist and Professor, and Jamie Nack, Extension Senior Wildlife Outreach Specialist, both in the Department of Forest and Wildlife Ecology. Join in, 800-642-1234, email to ideas@wpr.org. Let's go to Carol in Milton, Wisconsin. Hi, Carol.
Hi. Yeah, this is Carolyn Milton, and we had what was described as a very large black coyote in this area last year. I did not see that one, but it did kill one of the neighbor's calves. And what I saw was a brownish red large coyote that looked like a very large fox. But I saw it close up, and it was definitely a coyote. When I looked that sort of stuff up online, it said that the University of North Carolina has done a lot of research on coyotes, and they have large coyote hunts down there, and they were able to get samples of these coyotes, and they had gotten something like 2% of the coyotes in North Carolina are carrying dog genes, and they said that the color of the coyotes when they're, you know, not coyote color, are frequently coming from domestic dogs whose genes have gotten into the pool. I also know that wolves and coyotes cross in Ontario, and therefore it is not impossible for them to be wolf genes, at least in the black case.
Mm-hmm.
We have had a wolf pass through here a couple of times, but I don't know what color they were. We just,
saw them. Yeah. Well, comments from Jamie.
So I'm glad that you cited that research. It helped with the location. And to my knowledge, we have not seen the inbreeding between coyotes and wolves like they have in the eastern part of the country. And so there was a few years back that there was a television show on Nature or National Geographic. And when that hit, there were all sorts of questions for the Midwest as well. And that was really a phenomenon that was happening in the eastern part of the country, where the coyotes tend to be a little bit bigger in size. And so, I certainly don't doubt that research, and that, you know, you're seeing some traits from the domestic breeding, from the domestic genes showing those coat colors. But for Wisconsin, to my knowledge, we're not seeing that breeding going on between our wolves and coyotes. And thus our coyotes are still predominantly that gray with the reddish back. And sometimes, again, can be a little bit darker in color, but not to the point where they're uniform in black. So, David, I don't know if you have anything to add to that. But
Carol had mentioned the domestic dog being, in some cases, breeding with a coyote.
Yeah, I would agree with everything Jamie said. My understanding of the domestic dog breeding with coyotes is typically more common. And when I say common, I'm not saying that this happens all the time, so I'm not even sure how frequent this is, but that it typically happens more in rural areas where you may have feral dogs, and a feral dog may breed with a coyote, for example, in that situation. But again, I think that, you know, around here, we just have straight up coyotes. I don't think there's a lot of inbreeding going on between coyotes or interspecific breeding going on between coyotes and wolves. Certainly genetic research hasn't demonstrated that in the Midwest. I don't know how common it is between coyotes and dogs. And to get to her question about the attack on the calf or on the cow, you know, typically a coyote, unless that calf is small or sick or injured, a single coyote typically cannot take down a calf on its own, or cannot do it with ease. And so typically you would have more than one coyote that would attack a calf. And you know, certainly a single wolf could. And we have had wolves run through the southern part of the state in recent years. So that may have been what's going on. And without a kind of a forensic examination of the dead animal, the dead calf, we'll never know whether it was a coyote or a wolf, or it could be a large domestic dog, something like that too. So who knows? Mm-hmm. But typically, I would agree with everything that Jamie said. And you know, typically, we especially in the southern part of the state, we just have straight up coyotes.
Okay, Carol, thanks again. Tom in Janesville, your turn. Hi, Tom.
Hello there. I've got two owl boxes up. I live in the country and have two, you know, pretty large woodlots nearby, and I've had these owl houses up for two or three years, and they're inhabited by squirrels. I mean, it's impossible to keep the squirrels out of them. And so my question is there any point in putting them up if the squirrels are going to take them over, or will the owls drive the squirrels out and take them over when they want them?
Yeah, it might be an indication that there's some natural habitat already available that the owls are preferring, and so they're going to occupy a territory And so I don't know, do you commonly hear barred or great horned owls in your vicinity?
I hear great horned owls in the bigger woods every winter, and I have very rarely but occasionally heard screech owls.
Nice. So, you know, my thought would be they're preferring a natural cavity that they're reusing. I don't know, do you typically maintain your snags? So one of the best things you can do for owls naturally if you own woodlots is to leave your dead trees standing. Those openings, the holes, even the insects that are part of the decaying process can provide a food source for woodpeckers and other wildlife. So if you have snags or standing cavity trees in the woods, chances are that's what they're already using. Certainly can't hurt to put the boxes, and you may try relocating them to a different location, but that just might be, you know, what's available there in terms of, you know, there's already a territory occupied in your area.
Yeah, yeah, for sure. Thanks, Tom. Appreciate it. Ben in Menasha, your turn. Hi, Ben.
Hi, Larry. This is Ben. Thanks for taking the call.
Sure.
We put up a duck house. We have some woods behind our house, and one of our neighbors gave me as a birthday present two birthdays ago a wood duck house. So I put it up, and last year we didn't have enough water in the woods to attract any ducks. But this year, lo and behold, I put some fresh cedar mulch in the bottom of it, and within a week we had a screech owl that's been there all the time. So just
how
looking
fun.
For comments and wondering if now it's going to be a screech owl house forever, or if we clean it out in the spring, or should we, or what should we do at this point?
David?
So as Jamie mentioned when we started talking about birdhouses, is typically you would build a house that's specific to that species, and typically it's the diameter of the hole to get into that house that the species is looking for. So the fact that a screech owl is using it, unless you have a desire to use it simply for wood ducks, if you're content with a screech owl in there, I would just leave it be and just let whatever species wants to occupy that house in future years, let nature take its course, so to speak. If you don't, after the screech owl gets done nesting this year, you may want to try to move that box someplace else, a little bit closer to water or somewhere else where maybe the screech owl can't find it as easily. But regardless, it's pretty neat that you've got a screech owl in there, and I would enjoy that. And if you have a wildlife camera, you may want to put it up so that it is actually focusing on the box, and you can watch the screech owl come and go, and you can watch the owlets as they get older and start fledging from the house and things like that. So it's a pretty neat story.
Yeah. Jamie, anything to add?
Yeah, Ben, I was just going to add that it's time for you to build a couple more boxes. So you've got the one occupied by a screech owl, which is fabulous, super exciting. I would not hesitate to put up another wood duck box or two in that area and hope that the wood ducks will find it. So, and with those, you do want to clean out the shavings in late winter, clean everything out, and then add more shavings with the wood duck box. And I'm not sure, I was kind of curious to know whether you had that box mounted on a tree or on a pole, and sometimes how you mount it might reduce other species using it, like squirrels, for example, if you do a pole mount on your wood duck house.
Oh, yeah, you could do a pole mount and then have a sort of a squirrel excluder kind of thing on the pole itself to keep them out.
Yeah, a baffle, and that works good for raccoons and stuff too. So wood duck houses, if you can get them on a pole, they don't have to be mounted over water. Those little ducklings just bounce like a ping pong ball when they come out. So anyway, but Ben, I think it's time to build some more. You were good. 100% occupancy.
Yeah, that's right.
That's great, Ben. Thank you. Joe in Milwaukee, what's on your mind?
Hi, thanks for taking my call. I do a lot of deer hunting up in the Brule State Forest area, and I've been hunting up there for like 20 years plus. And over the last 5 years, I've noticed a lot more wolf tracks, either on some of the logging roads that I cover or in the fresh snow. And last couple of years, I've actually spotted some wolves on some of the roads crossing. My question is, you know, should I be concerned about my safety at all while scouting or harvesting a deer?
Oh, that's a great question.
So, and Larry, I think you should chime in on this too. I know you hunt in northern Wisconsin in wolf country and have encountered this too. So certainly you're entitled to, and if you get a concealed carry permit, you could conceal carry, but otherwise you can open carry for your personal protection. Of course, you'd have a deer rifle with you. And I think that gives some peace of mind, certainly, but I think just, you know, being aware of your surroundings as you're walking in and out of the woods. I mean, typically we enter the woods in the dark and we go out in the dark, and most wolves are going to be, you know, fearful of us and keep their distance. But there's certainly been situations where they're curious or they're wondering who's in their territory. So certainly doesn't hurt to have some, you know, protection, at least be prepared.
Yeah, at least be prepared. We can talk some more about that after we take a look at the news. Jamie Nack and David Drake, our guests today, and they'll be with us right up till 12:30. We'll talk about wolves, and we'll take your questions about wildlife as well at 1-800-642-1234. Back right after the news. Looking at the world of wildlife in Wisconsin today on the show with Jamie Nack and David Drake. Larry Mueller here. Thanks for joining us. Jamie, a senior wildlife outreach specialist. David, an extension wildlife specialist and professor, both in the Department of Forest and Wildlife Ecology at UW-Madison. So what wildlife questions do you have? Give a call. The number's 800-642-1234. Or you could send an email to ideas@wpr.org, ideas@wpr.org. And let's take some more calls. Elise in Sauk City, we'll turn to you next. Hi, Elise. Thanks for waiting.
Oh, my pleasure.
What did you find?
Yeah, I have a question about a Cooper's hawk. We live here in Sauk City. We're at the end of the village, and the Wisconsin River is in our backyard. And under our back deck stairs, there's a bed of hostas, and at this time of year, the hostas have all died back, so it looks pretty much like bare dirt. We were walking back there a couple of weeks ago, and we found a clump of feathers sticking up out of the dirt. And when we looked closer and gave a pull on those feathers, an entire Cooper's hawk came up out of the dirt, a dead bird, but freshly dead. And there was just a big hole in the dirt in the shape of its head. And we are mystified as to what happened.
Yeah, David, what do you think?
I'll give a couple of guesses here on this. So Cooper's hawks are very common, especially around houses, because they are a bird that eats other birds, especially birds that come to your bird feeder, like robins and juncos and things like that. So a couple of things that, based on the description and the proximity of the house, is I'm wondering if perhaps the Cooper's hawk hit the house or hit the window somehow and then fell into that location where you found it. Now, it doesn't necessarily explain the hole in the soil necessarily, but the only other explanation I would think of possibly is that some other animal killed that, or the Cooper's hawk was dead, another animal found it, and it went to bury it or to try to conceal it, and it chose that that spot that you found the Cooper's hawk. But those would be my two guesses.
Yeah, that makes one or the other of those is probably right. good points, David. Thanks, Elise. Appreciate it. Dave in Baraboo, your turn. Hi, Dave.
Hi. Yeah, thanks for taking the call. I'm up in the bluffs, and I've had bats living in I've got a metal pole building with a porch. There's pretty small holes, and there were a bunch of bats living in there. I sealed that up. I got a bat house, but I was reading online where it said that mounting it on metal buildings interferes with the bat's ability to get a good location. But I'm wondering, if I put it right up underneath the eaves, or put like a sheet of like 4x4 or 3x3 plywood on the building and then mount it to that. Is that going to be adequate to give them information when they're trying to home in on the house?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, Dave, that's a really good question. And I had not, you know, I've not heard about metal impacting their ability to locate the house. I was thinking the same thing, maybe putting a plywood sheet first. But if that truly is a concern, the other option would be to use a pole-mounted bat house. And in that case, you would probably want to get one that's multiple chambered so that there's some internal areas of that house. The internal chambers are warmer. And then certainly in either case, paint that bat house either brown or black so it absorbs the most sun in Wisconsin here. But I think if there truly is something to the metal buildings, then I think you'd want to avoid it altogether and put that house on a pole mount. David, any additional thoughts?
Haven't heard that either, but I guess it does make some sense because you would get that if they're using echolocation, you would get a pretty strong bounce back off that metal building. Yeah. But I haven't heard that either. But everything that Jamie said and Dave, what you've come up with is a possible solution that certainly would make some sense.
Yep, absolutely. Dave, thank you very much for calling. Nick in Green Bay, your turn. Hi, Nick.
Hi, Larry. Hope you're having a good New Year's. I got a question for you. Like, I was in the backyard. I got wood in the backyard. I live in Green Bay. I got wood in the backyard, which is so adventurous. I got a deck back there, and I noticed the other day that there's a big V where something's been digging. So I'm like, okay, whatever, as long as they're not destructive. Well, I don't know why. 10 o'clock at night, I went to look out the kitchen window. It faces the backyard, and all I saw was this big butt, like, flying back and forth from the bird feeder. And finally, I saw him, and my hypothesis is a flying squirrel. I got two questions. Should I really live trap him? And I heard that they might be protected underneath state law. And the other question is, are they destructive? And could it be a flying squirrel? Because it's about a 5-foot jaunt, and he fly. Like, he doesn't fly. He runs super fast from the deck underneath my bird feeders, gets a few seeds, and then runs back underneath the deck. And it's kind of humorous to watch. My son thinks it's hilarious. But as I said, I'm just worried about damage and stuff, and can I actually live trap him and be protected underneath state law? And he's really cool. Yeah. I mean, I don't mind him, but I just don't want him to destroy stuff.
Yeah.
Nick, that's a super cool observation, and I, you know, hopefully that is what you're seeing. One thing you could do is you could exchange your outdoor light for a red light, or add a red floodlight near that feeder because it would be coming in at night. They're not, flying squirrels are nocturnal, and you would see it probably more frequently and confirm that if you just put instead of a bright white light, but put a red floodlight on that bird feeder, you might see it coming in and going in and out. They are a protected species, so you couldn't trap and relocate them. But what I would do is just kind of monitor, you know, the siding on your house, you know, any holes or crevices that it might be able to come into. Occasionally, we do get reports of flying squirrels. Typically, they're, you know, like summer homes or cabins that people are vacationing at, and while they're away, they've made their entrance and are living in somebody's, you know, in a cabin attic or something like that. So I don't see too many problems with them, but they can occasionally get into an attic. So just kind of patrolling to make sure that you don't have any openings. You can also build nest boxes for them as well, and they'll utilize a natural cavity as well. And again, you know, that would be preferred over a human attic would be a natural cavity. So yeah, cute little buggers though. So
they are indeed. Thanks, Nick. Appreciate it very much. A listener emailed and is wondering what are chickadees eating when they dig into the black blobs on tree branches or the pin cherry blight?
Well, I don't know specifically on that particular tree, but you know, a pin cherry or choke cherry, that they could be possibly eating the berries, but it is possible that there are also some kind of insect or something that's an invertebrate that's in there that they're going after as well. Those are my thoughts on what they might be coming up with.
Yeah, that makes sense. Rick from Green Bay emailed, said he saw two bucks sparring in his backyard last night. And they weren't very aggressive, seemed more like they were playing almost. And Rick wants to know if this sparring is normal and do deer spar until they shed their antlers?
Yeah, it's an interesting observation. We just, our family pulled some trail cameras on a property that we hunt on. And there were some pictures of young bucks, so year-and-a-half-year-old, like forks and spikes, that were still sparring past what I would have thought was the rut. So some of it might, I'm not sure if he saw older, mature bucks or younger bucks, but I think some of it is just, you know, behaviorally playing and practicing the, you know, the rutting behavior. So anyway, that's very, very interesting. And certainly we're getting close here to having where the bucks are going to shed their antlers. And that occurs when we have the longer daylight, longer photo period. And then after the rut, the amount of testosterone starts to drop, and then they will eventually start dropping antlers here. So anyway, good observation. And we had a few on the camera still doing the same thing about a week or two ago.
There you go. When you mentioned sheds, I got to thinking about the video, Deer Hunt 2021, which has a great segment within it on shed hunting. And I enjoyed that very much. And I'm sure that's still up. And you could go and take a look at that part of it. You could watch the whole thing. But that part of it I thought was really interesting in Deer Hunt 2021. They did a really nice job with it. Doug, you know, he called earlier to talk with us about the Haughey Historic District Park near Mount Horeb as a place to hike, and he emailed the address of the hiking trail. It's the Haughey District Park is at 1399 County Road Z near Mount Horeb. So County Road Z near Mount Horeb, and the number is 1399 County Road Z. Or you could just go online to the Haughey Historic District Park, and they've got a website, and you can take a look at it there. Luke in Madison up next. Luke, hi, thank you for calling.
Hi, Larry. I have a quick question. Perhaps it's not so quick, but I'll get to it. I was up deer hunting years ago up in northern Wisconsin, Burnett County, and I saw an American fisher creeping out into towards a swampy area, right? And it's going real slow-like. And it gets it's about 40 yards from me, something like that. Anyway, it's very still. And then out of the marsh grass pops a grouse, a rough grouse. And then out from nowhere, a Cooper's hawk hits the grouse and goes down. And then the American fisher gets all excited and then turns around and just kind of trots off, you know, as they normally do. And my question was, I'm aware of different, you know, biological associations in nature. And I was wondering if anyone's ever looked into the possibility of a hawk-fisher type thing, because say you're a hawk, it would be easy to follow a fisher around in the snow. And if you're a fisher, it would be fairly easy to see a hawk posted somewhere and maybe know that your quarry might be less inclined to flush on you. So maybe both predators could benefit from following each other around in such a fashion as we've seen with coyotes and badgers, for instance. Yeah. I was wondering if that's a thing anyone's looked into, or maybe just a fluke of the one in a million chance that I happen to see something.
Wow, that was a pretty interesting observation and a pretty interesting thought that Luke has there, too, about one predator maybe helping out another predator, probably unknowingly, but...
Yeah, I think... go on, Jamie.
Nope, go ahead, David.
I was just going to say, that's the first I've heard of that, but it certainly would make sense, what you're saying, and... you know, it's certainly, we know of other animal species that work together to cooperatively hunt. As you mentioned, the badger and the coyote's a pretty famous one as well. But that's a really neat story.
Yeah, I loved it. Luke, thanks a lot for sharing that with us. Appreciate it. Sarah in Libertyville, we'll go to you. Hi, Sarah.
Hi there, Larry. I'm so glad your show is still happening. When I was living in Zion last year, which is right near the lake up north in Illinois, One day I walked out of my apartment building during this really, really cold snap. And I saw this dead hawk, like freshly dead hawk, just lying at my feet. I was very upset. But then I noticed that it had a band around its leg. So I thought, oh, I should do something about this. So I called down here. We have these forest preserve districts. So I managed to get in contact with the naturalist there. And she was like all over it. I just couldn't believe it. It was like code red at the forest preserve. And she contacted this other person who would know something. And I sent them photos, and they discovered that it was part of a federal study. And they were like, put it in your freezer. No, we have, like, they wanted it immediately. So I just put it in a box and drove it out to their office, and they were just very excited about it. That's my story.
Oh, it's a great story. I love
it. Can I ask a question while you're still online? Was it the United States Wildlife Services, USDA Wildlife Services, that you brought to their office?
Well, I took it to the local. I took it to the local forest reserve naturalist, and he gotcha. Said he would get it to the right person.
Okay. Yeah.
That's pretty cool. That's
pretty neat. There's a lot of bird banding efforts going on across the United States, and we ban birds of all different sizes, from hummingbirds all the way up to eagles. But because you mentioned hawk, that's not as common. But sometimes hawks are rehabilitated at a licensed wildlife rehabilitator, and sometimes they'll ban the hawk when they release it to know that it's been rehabilitated. And sometimes USDA Wildlife Services is a federal agency that manages wildlife at airports, for example, to keep air traffic safe as they land, take off, fly, things like that. And if hawks and owls are found at the airport, a lot of times they'll live trap them, ban them, and then take them miles and miles away and release them. And they ban them so they know if the animal returns that it's a returning hawk. And so that's why I was curious as to if you knew exactly who had banded the hawk or not.
Interesting. That's another cool story. Thank you, Sarah. Mary from Madison called but couldn't stay with us. She would love it if we could play the sound of a screech owl. She doesn't have internet and would love to hear a recording. Tyler, have you got something? That's an Eastern screech owl.
Yep. It's the horse whinny, and then they also screech as well. They have a different call than that, but yeah, that's pretty neat.
Yeah, there we go. Tyler found it. Sharon in Minocqua, your turn. Hi, Sharon.
Hi, Larry. This is another great program. I'm calling about, I had a wonderful experience last year in my backyard with about a couple of hundred amber-winged dragonflies that emerged at the same time and just perched themselves in one of my oak trees. It was just so beautiful. There were like little ornaments hanging off of the oak trees. But I just wanted to make a comment. I've lived in some pretty amazing places with natural resources. And when I moved to Wisconsin, I was just amazed at how many dragonflies and damselflies there are here. This is like, it's like you just dropped me into damselfly, dragonfly heaven with so many species and so many great places to see them. But this was pretty spectacular. And I put a post, you know, the other thing too is the resources that are available for identification of, you know, the Odinate, you know, with the Wisconsin Odinate survey. So that was pretty spectacular to see.
That's a great story. And Sharon, you're living in a wonderful area. I love the Minocqua area. I've done a lot of musky fishing and biking and all kinds of things in that area. So thanks so much for calling. That's pretty spectacular, isn't it, Jamie?
Yeah, it sure is. It's amazing. As we travel and when we were traveling more out of state, I mean, it's just always amazing to come back to Wisconsin and having the seasons and the habitat diversity, and just such an outdoor state in general. We're pretty blessed, and I think we take that for granted at times. So,
yeah, Laura from Menominee Falls emailed and said a robin built a nest on her house several years ago, and since then, many birds have come to that nest. The birds almost remodel the nest so it keeps getting bigger. And she's wondering if she should remove the nest and allow the new birds to start fresh.
Yeah, so I think, you know, you certainly can. Once they have fledged the eggs, there's no eggs, no nestlings, you legally can go ahead and remove that and dispose of it. And if you're interested, if you're okay with another bird coming and building a nest, there's a good chance that you'll have another robin do the very same thing next year or this spring. If you're not interested, after you remove that nest, come spring, you might want to put something up there to prevent that bird from building a nest on your, you know, if it's a front porch light or things like that. So it all depends on your acceptability of a nest being there. So you can go ahead and remove the old nest.
David, another popular activity in winter is moonlight or candlelight hikes through Wisconsin state parks. Any recommendations there?
You know what? I tend to go to parks or areas that are near me. So I live in Middleton, which is a suburb of Madison, for those of you not in the Madison area. And, you know, around Middleton, I live within walking distance of Pheasant Branch Conservancy, which is a local conservancy area that I absolutely adore, use it regularly to hike, you know, walk, bird, run. Governor Nelson State Park is in the Madison area. That's another one that I really enjoy. And I really enjoy the Ice Age Trail quite a bit. So those are some areas that are local to me, and I tend to stay in that area that's local. But you know, there's some wonderful places throughout the state, and I think whatever's accessible to you, I think we would all encourage you to get outside, take your kids outside, do it as a family, do it individually. And there's some wonderful activities such as these outdoor nighttime hikes where they've got candles burning or some kind of lighted trail, and you can hike or snowshoe or cross country ski. And, you know, sometimes the snowshoes or the skis are available if you don't have those, so you can try them out. And some of the hikes are led and guided, and sometimes you can do it on your own. So whatever it is, just get outside and enjoy the great outdoors, get some fresh air in your lungs, and just get some exercise.
I've been on some of those. They're really a lot of fun, those candlelit ones at night. And on that note, here we are out of time. Gee, it flew by. Thank you so much, Jamie and David, for being with us today. And we'll look forward to your next visit in probably a couple of months.
Yep,
look forward
Thanks,
to
Larry.
It. Thank you so much. David Drake, Extension Wildlife Specialist and Professor, and Jamie Nack, Extension Senior Wildlife Outreach Specialist. They both reside in the Department of Forest and Wildlife Ecology. Great to have them with us, and they'll be back. Scott Craven will be back first Wednesday of next month. Tomorrow on the show, we'll talk about the relationship between pests and crops with a UW professor who's been studying that topic for decades. And then at 11:45, we'll talk with the leader of a Midwest energy organization about solar energy. In the meantime, thank you so much for listening. Stay with us. Lots in store. I'm Larry Mueller.